The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD and UD Information Technologies present Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon, manager of the IT Communication Group at the University of Delaware.
Thank you, Jason. Our guest today is Katie Fortney. She's the Copyright Policy and Education Officer from the California Digital Library, which serves all the campuses of the University of California system. Now, Katie was trained as both a librarian and a lawyer, so she has a balanced perspective on copyright issues from both a librarian's and a lawyer's point of view. And we're talking with her because she came to the UD campus in November of 2013 and spoke about her work on an unusual bit of digital humanities, the Grateful Dead Archive Online. Katie, I thought that was a very approachable and friendly talk about copyright as it pertains to digital scholars.
Thank you. That's what I aim for. I try to go kind of nuts and bolts, cocktail party level when I talk copyright. I also talk with really super nerdy lawyers about, you know, super how many angels on the head of a pin in this copyright law can we do. But usually practical stuff is what I get into, and everybody likes to hear about the Grateful Dead website.
Now, your talk here was really fun. I thought it was thought-provoking. You introduced a lot of people to the concept of copyright risk assessment, or as you say in the title of one of your papers recently, copyright risk assessment for digitizing recent historical collections.
Yes, that was a nice, fancy-sounding proposal title. But yeah, that's just talking about the fact that we don't always need permission, and I wouldn't say that that approach is new, but the fact that we're talking about this more, moving away from just assuming that you need permission to put anything online, assuming you need permission to make copies of things. And I think the Library of Congress did it 15 years ago, scanned a bunch of papers and put them online without permission as fair use. And probably folks were doing it earlier, but it's kind of hard to find folks because I think people feel like it's a little bit clandestine, it's a little bit naughty, even though they check the law and they know it's right, but people are starting to brag about it more, which is great.
Well, I mean, it seems like that's the conservative advice most librarians give scholars is, oh, don't do that. Someone might object.
Yeah, some places will definitely still give you that advice. It depends what the risk tolerance is at your particular institution. It depends on who you're talking to and how recent the copyright case law is that they know about, or if they even know much about copyright or just are repeating what they've heard.
Well, we're going to have to obviously talk about some of the basics of copyright, but let's talk first about what's special about the digital humanities. I mean, that's a phrase that people might have been reading about, not really aware of what that means. What kinds of projects fall under that umbrella?
Well, and I confess I'm not a digital humanities expert myself. I'm a digital humanities looker on from the perspective of copyright, and why these projects sound cool to me. And there's things things like 3D interactive exhibits from old maps. People are crawling piles and piles of old books and texts to examine the way that vocabulary and syntax evolve. Wacky things like this are new. They're special for copyright purposes because they're transformative, and transformativeness is something that comes up a lot in fair use, which is my favorite part of copyright law. A lot of digital humanities projects actually work with works that are not in copyright at all, and so I kind of don't pay as much attention to those ones.
Things that are really old and have already fallen into the public domain, that kind of
thing. Yes.
But I think some of the things that, for example, the talk you gave about the Grateful Dead Archive Online or the Iowa project that both you and in 2012 Kenny Cruz talked with us about when he came to campus, those both present some interesting issues in terms of managing the copyright.
Yeah, because they're using these materials in ways that the people who created them never thought about. So in the Grateful Dead project, there were all these concert posters, and those were created to sell tickets to a concert. And now it's 20 or 30 years later, so the copyright in those things is not going to expire for you know, basically forever. But people want to look at them now for completely different reasons, to examine, you know, the icons that were used at the time, the different kind of visual tropes that came up in these things, and the use of color, and just the way that stuff was talked about.
In the Grateful Dead archive online, another thing I thought was really cool is you talking about the envelopes that people would submit when they would request tickets.
Yes. And when I periodically I'd search around for stuff on similar projects, and I actually found somebody who had a school paper or a proposal they were writing about, and it was before the website had come online. And it was like, you know what would be really cool is if, as a research project, you could download all the text from these envelopes and track things like, you know, were women more likely to request tickets than men, and how far from home were these people asking for tickets to, like, were people mostly requesting, you know, compare the show they were requesting to the return address on the envelope, and all this crazy stuff that, you know, I just thought, these are some fun-looking envelopes. But there's research there to be done.
Now, for those of you who are considerably younger than I am or have not been studying Grateful Dead archives or helping advise scholars who are putting together the Grateful Dead archive, let me put it that way, better explain to the folks what we're talking about with these envelopes.
Yeah, so starting in the, I think the 80s, this is how you would get tickets to Grateful Dead shows. You wouldn't go to Ticketmaster or StubHub. You would send a self-addressed stamped envelope to Grateful Dead ticket sales at a post office box, and then they would send you back tickets if they had enough, depending on, I don't know exactly how they picked them. I read about how they picked which ones, but it was something about the order they came in on or something like that. But people thought, you know, I'll try to catch the eye of the people handing out the tickets. And the cooler my envelope is, the more likely it is that I'm going to get some. And also, it was just fun. I mean, if you really, really love Jerry Garcia, the fact that maybe your envelope would find its way to a table where he could walk by and decide he really liked your art, that would be pretty exciting.
Now, this gets into an interesting thing with copyright. I know it puzzles my students sometimes. The Grateful Dead people had the envelope, but who owns the copyright?
The artist. So in United States copyright law, the author or creator of a work owns the copyright in that thing until they sign away or otherwise transfer the copyright, and it doesn't travel with the work at all. So you buy a painting, you don't have the work to the right to do anything with that painting other than hang it in your house and certain other rights that come along. But you certainly don't have the right to sell posters of that painting.
So as a result, then, you guys had to make some decisions, or you were having to advise the scholars as they're making their decisions about which envelopes to put up, about what to do about the copyright, because you couldn't possibly contact the copyright holders for all these tens of thousands of envelopes.
No, that would have been impossible. First of all, we had return addresses, but, you know, there were 15,000 of them, and who knows if those people were still there 15 years later. But because our purpose was so much different than their purpose, and because we walked through fair use, which I'm sure we will get to here shortly, we decided it was a low-risk thing to do to put these envelopes up. And for the most part, people have been thrilled to see them there.
Excellent. Now, what's the Iowa project? This is one that I think is really interesting, where they're like sort of crowdsourcing documents from the 19th century. Is that right?
I'm not super familiar with that one. I've been to their website briefly, but yeah, my understanding is they've scanned them and then they're crowdsourcing the transcription. Because handwriting, especially in, you know, really old letters, that's not something you can run through your OCR and just figure out what the text is that way.
So these are old family letters, and then they're posting them on the web and asking people to help.
Yes.
You will translate from the handwriting, or, oh, that was my great uncle's sister-in-law or something like that, and add commentary.
DIY history, they call it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How does that fit into copyright in terms of scholarship and digital humanities kinds of projects? That also would raise some interesting challenges, I'd imagine.
Right. I'm sure they had to sit there and think about, well, do the people doing the transcribing, are they now joint copyright holders in the project? And I would have to think about that one a minute myself. I imagine just to keep everything clear and easy, they have people who are doing the project check a little box that says, I'm not making any claims here. But I believe, let's see, so the original works are in the public domain because of their age, and it's just a translation of them with no new creative authorship attached. So yeah, I would say there's probably not a lot of real concern, basis for concern there.
And people are willingly submitting the information. I think it's probably time for us to let the folks at home learn more about this fair use of which you and I have been speaking.
It is my favorite. So fair use, which we rely on all the time, every day without thinking about it, is part of United States copyright law and pretty unique to United States copyright law. It's based on four factors, which I will quickly run through. The purpose, what your purpose is in copying or using the work, the nature of the work that you're copying, the amount of it that you're using, and the effect on reasonable markets for that work. And those are all over the internet and easily Googleable if you want to find them. So there's four of them, and they have different sub-factors. They're multifaceted. They're interrelated. And it gets pretty complex in a hurry. Lawyers love it, and normal people don't.
That's right. Normal people want to see a list of, you can use 30 seconds out of this song, or you can use 1 minute out of each hour of this movie. But it's not like that at all, is it?
No, there's very little always and never in fair use. There's a whole lot of probably and probably not, and there are some shortcuts. So like when I talked about when I visited last fall was that if you have a good use, if you would win on the first factor, if you have a educational non-commercial use, and then at the same time you would win the fourth factor so that you're not affecting anybody else's reasonable market, then the vast majority of the time, judges are going to find that to be fair use. That's one of the main ones that comes up a lot in libraries and things that scholars are interested in that aren't necessarily a commercial product. Another one that comes up a lot in digital humanities, I talked about earlier, transformativeness. And another kind of shorthand, condensed way to look at fair use is to ask two questions. One is what you're doing transformative, which means not necessarily that you're mushing the thing up, but that you're using it for a very different purpose, and that if it is, if your use is transformative, then are you just using an amount appropriate to your purpose? And I think a lot of what's going on today in digital humanities and things like Google Books even are taking advantage of that aspect of the law.
Well, wait a minute. You raised Google Books. How the heck is Google Books transformative? I mean, I thought they were copying the entire work.
They sure did, a bunch of them. But the court in that case said that it's you're using them in transformative ways. So you can't take a library full of books and search the full text of that. You can do that with Google Books. And the supporting briefs for that case were full of examples of scholars saying either the great things that they'd managed to find or the great analysis that they were now capable of doing, just based on being able to search all these books at the same time, not just the titles, not just the authors, but the full text of the things. Also enabling them to be used by print-disabled individuals, things like that that the originals couldn't do.
Still sounds to me, though, that Google Books copying 19 gazillion books and putting them up online violates the copyright holder's rights to control reproduction and distribution.
Well, that's what some of the publishers and authors think, and so that case is being appealed. But you can't go and just read the book on Google Books. They only display snippets. So if you want to read more than the sentence around where your word appears, you do have to go and buy that book.
Okay, you understand I'm playing devil's advocate
there. I do, and I'm trying to fill in there.
The fair use exception to the copyright law is something that I know that on our campus, and you've probably run into this out in the California university system, some faculty think anything they do, because we're in an educational institution, is fair use. And I should be, that's a fair use exception to the copyright law. I should be able to do that.
Yeah, I've heard that many times, and I feel bad when I do this because I am a librarian and I'm a lawyer, but I really love, there's a page on Wikipedia, which is a wonderful thing in its own way, of common fair use misconceptions, and that one is on there, that everything educational or everything nonprofit is a fair use, and so is its opposite, that everything that makes money can never be a fair use, and that one's not true either.
Well, let's move out of the scholarship field and just ask about ordinary Joes who might be listening to this as they're driving along the I-95. How does fair use impact, the fair use exception to copyright impact ordinary Joes? I mean, we all tend to make copies of things and give them away to people.
Sometimes we do, and sometimes that's fine. And my own personal risk assessment is very similar to what I do for the libraries, is I say things like, well, who's going to find out? Who would actually be mad? And would they be mad enough to do anything about it? That is not legal advice. That is, your practical friend who watches the news. But there's a lot of great resources out there. I think listening to somebody talk about it is never the best way to learn something like this, but there's lots of good things to read and to watch. So the Wikipedia list of common misunderstandings about fair use is a good one. YouTube came out with a movie a while ago called Copyright School, which got a lot of folks in the copyright community pretty up in arms because they thought it was one-sided. So then there was a contest to rebut that with Fair Use School. And if you Google YouTube Fair Use School, there's a great video that explains for things like YouTube in particular, but also online photo services and things like Pinterest, like how to get a feel for what you're doing is fair use. If you're doing a mashup or if you're doing repurposing or parody or something like that.
All right, let's quiz you on an example here. I think I shared with you online an article in the union leader from, I think, Raleigh, North Carolina. But anyway, where the lawyer who's writing the column was asked, is it fair use if my company subscribes to a journal and then we make copies of articles and pass around to the other people who work here?
So that one is in the business pages and it says specifically my company. And because of that commercial nature, if you're a commercial enterprise like that, courts are less likely to find that so to be fair use. And, you know, on that one, there's actually a case. Texaco, was it Texaco? I'm going to have to refresh my memory. Got sued about that and lost. So, but it's a very different scenario from, you know, making a copy from a newspaper, a magazine to give to a friend or making a copy of something to share with your class or your teacher. But when you're using it to make money, then that gets a little less likely. But, you know, it depends. I could probably spin out a crazy scenario or two where it would still be fair use in the context of a for-profit company. But that's just one more factor that weighs against you.
Well, it depends is quite often the answer.
Yep. I start just about every conversation that way.
Well, I think in the Texaco case, if my memory serves me right, they were one of their research units, so they thought research, that's good, that counts as fair use, was as a pattern subscribing to one copy of a journal, and the librarian was passing around the table of contents and having people check which ones they wanted copies made of. And so I think that was the kind of thing where it came down to, well, you are harming the market, and it is, as you say, for commercial research. So I don't know. That's my English major who works in a computing center analysis.
Yeah, I could see reasonable lawyers who would have disagreed with that case, but that'll happen a lot. I was watching some copyright testimony last week where you had law professors saying that they thought, you know, federal appeals court, circuit court decisions had been wrongly decided in copyright. So you can always find somebody to argue with you about it. But that one there is in the middle enough where you get 100 lawyers in the room and you're not going to get, you know, 95 of them to agree.
What I think is funny is sometimes you look around and my students find this is crazy for them, too, is that it depends sometimes what court the case is heard in. That, you know, that different circuits have different patterns, if you will, in copyright law.
And different judges within different circuits, just depending on what they're where they're coming from.
Well, here we go with some more it depends kind of questions for you.
Oh, good.
All right. So I'm getting ready to do my first lecture of the semester tomorrow, and I run across a cartoon. Can I go ahead and put that up on my slides under the fair use exception of the copyright law?
Well, it depends.
I knew she'd say that.
It always depends. And I know that some folks would say, well, yeah, if you're just using it once, but stuff like cartoons and stuff where it's, if it's just funny or if it's just pretty, I tend to be a little more hesitant on those. When you're teaching a course, a good question to ask is, you know, do I really need this exact image or this exact cartoon that I'm using? If you could use something else that's equally pretty, then no, that's not fair use. But if you need to use this cartoon because, you know, say it demonstrates some the racial bias inherent in blah blah political cartoons of such and such a year, then sure, you need that particular cartoon or one nearly identical, and you're very limited to your purpose there. Is that making sense?
Yeah, it's making sense. I was hoping you were going to say, oh, you're doing classroom teaching, so you've got a lot of leeway.
You've got a lot of leeway, but not anything.
It still depends.
It still depends. And again, you know, when I hear classroom teaching these days, I don't just assume you're showing it to 10 people. I have to wonder, is this being recorded for a MOOC, and is this going to be watchable by YouTube by thousands of people? So there's classroom use and there's classroom use.
I remember I attended a copyright seminar once, and I was shocked that they were using copyrighted cartoons in the talks at this conference, and this was, like, if you will, a dog and pony show they were taking around the country. I mean, to me, that would not have been fair use.
Well, yeah, I'd have to see what they're using them for. I'd have to know what their comfort level with risk was. You know, if maybe that was a close call and they were comfortable with it. Maybe they had permission. Maybe they knew the artist.
Well, they said they didn't know the artist and they did not receive permission.
They were just using them.
They thought it was fair use. But then at the time, I was very conservative. I had yet to hear you speaking on the topic of risk assessment. All right, well, here's a real one. I'm DJing on WVUD, and a listener calls in and requests something that we don't have, but I find it on YouTube. Now, I will say WVUD and the University of Delaware have paid all the appropriate licensing fees to BMI, ASCAP, and CSAC. Am I allowed to play the song on the air from YouTube?
I'm not sure that BMI cares where you get it. I don't spend a lot of time looking at BMI kind of stuff. I spend my time hanging out in library special collections. But I would wonder whether you might be violating your YouTube terms of service. So every time you go and use something like YouTube or Facebook or Instagram, you scroll past paragraphs of really dense text that nobody ever reads. And sometimes they say things like, you will not reproduce this anywhere. You will not share it with anybody who's not a subscriber. You will not make any copies, even for personal use. All kinds of stuff that takes you completely outside of copyright law. And then you have to obey it just because you agreed to it. I think there was somebody did a dramatic reading of the iTunes terms of service by a famous actor. And even then,
I hope
you couldn't listen to it.
Shatner.
That would be great.
Well, I mean, but this gets into the whole thing that is raised by social media. I mean, Pinterest and YouTube, Facebook, even Twitter. I mean, people are putting up copies of copyrighted cartoons and photographs they're finding in other places. Sometimes they're transforming them by putting some witty saying on it to make it a meme. I just think that it's really getting into an area that we really haven't educated what the law is going to decide on some of these things.
Well, and we are dealing with a law that never contemplated that ordinary people would be taking millions of photographs that would be easily reproduced. We're dealing with copyright that originally was like, okay, so you have a book and you need a pretty large infrastructure to copy a book. And so we only need to worry about pretty resource-intensive copying. It's so easy for anyone to make copies now, and it's so easy for everyone to publish, to self-publish on their blog or their Twitter or wherever, that the law is, and people's kind of sense of what's right under the law is still catching up.
One of the things that I think is interesting, it usually you hear about it in terms of people trying to suppress information about hacking into computers, that kind of thing, where people tend to use copyright infringement actions to restrict others' free speech. An example just came up I saw this afternoon before I came into the studio where Britney Spears and Steven Tyler are saying artists should be allowed to tell people, no, you can't use that clip if they disagree with what the person is going to be doing with a clip from their song.
And I can see where they're coming from. I think a lot of people during the last presidential campaign, I remember different bands getting really irritated that their songs were being used in Mitt Romney ads. And sorry, where were we? What was the original question?
I was rambling on about whether or not people are using copyright infringement to restrict others' rights of free speech.
So copyright is a favorite for people to trot out to scare people with because it's scary, because it has statutory damages, which are huge, and you don't actually have to prove that anyone has cost you any money. You just have to prove that they infringed your copyright. And there was the case where somebody made their own mix CD from songs they downloaded from Kazaa just for their own personal use, and the court said they had to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars, which of course bears no resemblance to what the bands or the recording companies actually lost. People hear about stuff like that, and so when you hear copyright infringement, that automatically kind of scares people, and so people wield that as a blunt instrument.
You're listening to Two Copyright Nerds here on Campus Voices on WVUD. Yes, I admit it. I'm a copyright nerd. So is Katie Fortney, the Copyright and Policy Education Officer for the California Digital Library. And she's been kind enough to Skype in and chat with us. As we close down, let's engage in some wishful thinking. What changes would you like to see in how scholars and libraries approach copyright issues, especially as we've got this beast called the Internet, which is really allowing more collaboration and sharing and development of online resources than people thought of when they wrote the original law?
Two things I would like to see, and they're related. I would like to see people take more sensible risk to know their rights better. And in order to do that, and because there's other good reasons to do it, they're going to need to know more. I would like to see basic copyright literacy be part of what we in the libraries call information literacy. I would like to see that talked about, copyright issues and other intellectual property issues, in the courses where they are particularly relevant. I have a cousin who graduated with a degree in film and never really heard about copyright stuff. And so you get, you know, fresh documentary filmmakers who don't know if they can use news clips in the movies that they're making. So I want to see better copyright education. I want to see understandable laws and materials interpreting them so that people can use them, because they do have rights that they're not using. Fair use being high among them, but others. And also, people, I don't want people stumbling blindly into things you see on YouTube all the time, people posting things that they have no right to post, and then they put this disclaimer, no copyright infringement intended, as if that's helpful. And unfortunately, it's not.
Any changes you'd like to see made to the law, or should we not go there?
I think we have to go there, whether we want to or not. I am a little bit afraid of it, of Congress reopening copyright law, because, you know, who knows what they're going to do to it. Maybe with lobbyists being very active, they would make it worse. But there are hearings on it right now. The Copyright Register has come out and said, we need the next great copyright act. I don't think it's going to be this year, but sometime, you know, in the next maybe 4 years, we will see new copyright law. And there's lots of stuff that I would like to see changed. I think the biggest two for people just trying to go about their day-to-day is the damages issue that we talked about. Either for nonprofits or for personal use, for certain cases that are not giant piracy operations, we should either be able to waive damages, or we should limit damages to what they actually cost the people who are suing. I'd also like to see better term limits. I mean, when we first had copyright law in this country, it was your work was protected for 14 years and you could renew it for another 14. Which isn't bad, really. You can make a lot of money off a movie or a book or a song in 28 years. And now we've got 95 years, or life plus 70. And some of that we can't do anything about because we are party to international treaties, but we can do some things. Those are the two big ones that I'd like to see. I also have kind of a grudge against the DMCA.
As do I. I mean, who heard of it? A copyright law that not just extends copyright to new works, but also extends it to methods of protecting the works.
Yeah, the anti-circumvention provisions are, yeah, one of my personal bugbears. But yeah, I mean, if right now, basically any court in the country would tell you that, you know, burning a personal copy of your own DVD is illegal. You make a copy of a VHS tape and you're fine, but because to burn the DVD, you have to break the encryption on the DVD, you're subject to horrible, scary damages. I would love to see that go away.
Katie, thank you so much for spending a half hour with us here on Campus Voices on WVUD.
You're welcome. It was fun.
Good. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices, a collaboration between WVUD, the broadcast voice of the University of Delaware, and UD Information Technologies. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD, UD Information Technologies, or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.